What is the subject today? Does anybody know? The feast of the Lord? Well, let me ask you this. What does the word feast mean to you?
Time of celebration.
A feast? If I say, come to my house for a feast, what would you expect?
I expect food.
Exactly. Now, does the word feast in this portion have anything to do with coming to eat?
Yes.
In what way? No. Well, let me ask you this. When they offer up the first fruits, what do they eat? When they blow the trumpet, what do they eat? What the word is this. Turn to Leviticus 23, because it's essential that you know precisely. Leviticus chapter 23. What we're studying today, because the word feast is misleading, and this is what it says. Leviticus 23, starting at verse 1, and I will translate it literally for you. Leviticus 23, verse 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, the set feasts of the Lord, which is literally the appointments, the fixed times, is not the word feast at all. It's simply appointments. So forget the word feast in the sense of eating and drinking and celebrating, because on one of the feasts, they do no eating. What is that? What feast? No, on one of the... Very good. Very good. It says, you shall afflict your souls. And that afflict your souls means you shall fast. They did no eating on the Day of Atonement. So forget the word feast. And what we're studying today are the fixed times, the appointments that God has made for the children of Israel. He says, I'm fixing this time. It is an appointment. So these seven subjects that we're going to consider in Leviticus chapter 23 are appointments which are called, and I'll show you how it describes them for us. Verse 4. Look at verse 4. These are the appointments of the Lord, even holy convocations. Be thankful that when God gives you a term, so often he will describe it in the very next word. So these appointments are what?
Holy convocation.
All right. What is a convocation? Exactly. The word convocation means a calling together, a gathering together. But these are not just ordinary convocations, but they are holy convocations. So when you have an appointment with God, what is it? A holy appointment with God. Now, for this reason, what should be our attitude whenever we meet God, whenever we have an appointment with God? It's a holy convocation. It's something sacred. It is something special. So all of these appointments, God tells us, they are special. They are holy convocations. All right. The first question I want to ask you is this. What is the difference in our study in Leviticus chapter 23 and the seven appointments that God makes if we study them individually? Are all the appointments of God that we have, are they just as they are in Leviticus 23, or are they found individually in the Old Testament? Give me an example where one is found individually.
Sabbath. In Numbers.
The Sabbath?
Passover and Exodus 12.
Very good. And the most important one that is elaborated, the Day of Atonement, which is found in Leviticus chapter 16. So understand this, that you can study these appointments of the Lord. You can study them either collectively or individually. Let me ask you this. How many parables of the Lord are found in Matthew chapter 13? What? No. I thought you would know. Seven with an eight is a parabolic illustration. So that how many churches are there in Revelation 2 and 3?
Seven.
I see. So it speaks in the scripture about remember the Sabbath, and the Sabbath is what day? The seventh day. And there are seven churches, and here there are seven appointments, and what happens on the seventh in this chapter? Seven, and then the 50th day is what?
Pentecost.
Very good. And what happens every seventh year? All the slaves are freed. And what happens every seven times 7 years? Very good. The 50. And what happens seven times 70 years? Very well, in Daniel chapter 9. So, whenever you find God explaining things individually, it means one thing. But when you find God putting them all together, there is a specific reason. There are seven appointments that God tells us about in this chapter. What is the difference if God tells us about one of these appointments individually and when he tells us about them collectively? All of them, even though they're just mentioned collectively here briefly, when you find them mentioned individually, it's simply an expansion of what you have here. The difference is this, that when they are looked at collectively, you get a picture of the life of Israel, the center of Israel, and what they and their relation to God are to do. I mention that for this reason.
Can you say that again?
Yes. When you have all seven of them together, it is the life of Israel in their relation to God and in their relation to one another. Not just one, but both of them. And it tells us something about Israel. In what chapter is the first Passover kept? Exodus 12. All right. Now, I tell you what I'm going to do.
I'm sorry, did you say something individually? Collectively, then?
Collectively, yes. Perhaps I'll repeat it later. Collectively.
Yeah, right, that's what I was getting.
Exactly.
I understand collectively.
That is what we're going to find out later. What I do, Tim, is that I do not go in an orderly way. I'm liable to mention one feast and go to another, but at the end, you put it all together. You hope you do. But first of all, when they are mentioned collectively, it shows what a theocracy is, what it's built around, what its center is. It shows their relationship to God. It shows, since there is to be a holy convocation, if it's a holy getting together, is it something individual or is it something that includes all of the children of Israel? All of them. So here in Leviticus 23, we see the life of Israel, and God has told us, since he is the one who made these appointments, it wasn't man that made these appointments with God, it was God who made these appointments with men. He says that when you come together, I don't want you to worship me individually, I want you to worship me collectively. For this reason, on the first day of the week in Acts chapter 20, they gathered together to break bread. The Lord Jesus also speaks about worship in an individual way in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, when you pray, enter into your closet
How many of you take people in the closet with you when you pray? That's individual. But how many of you remember the Lord with the breaking of bread and the drinking of the cup? How many of you remember that individually? You can't do that individually. You have to do that collectively. So all of these feasts are spoken of in their collective sense because it involves all of the children of Israel. Now, there are seven appointments. How many of the seven does God say Israel has to attend?
All.
No. That's a good guess. But scripturally,
one.
That is a good guess, but that's the one that they didn't have to attend.
Passover.
The Passover? No, that one isn't commanded to be attended.
The Sabbath.
The Sabbath isn't one of these appointments. That is something extra from it.
We're narrowing it down.
Yes, let's read this. You'll find it in Exodus 23, Exodus 34, and Deuteronomy 16. Three times. I thought you might have found one of them.
Feast of Booths.
See, 1 second. That's one. But let's look, for simplicity's sake, in Deuteronomy 16. Look at Deuteronomy 16. And someone read me verse 16.
Three times in a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place which you choose.
So, how many times?
Three times.
Three times. Not seven, but three. But go ahead. In what?
At the Feast of Unleavened Bread.
Yes.
And at the Feast of Weeks.
Yes.
And at the Feast of Booths.
Exactly. All right. So, the ones that you mentioned aren't even necessitated to attend. But this is what is of great interest. When it says the Feast of Unleavened Bread, how close was the Passover to the Feast of Unleavened Bread? What? Very good. And the Feast of First Fruits, how close was it to the Day of Unleavened Bread? The next day. And so you have on the 14th, 15th, and 16th, I'll tell you about that later, if you had to be there for the Feast of Unleavened Bread, what do you think you would be there in addition to? Very good. You've got it. And then there is an interval from the first month to the third month. And then you have the Feast of Weeks that we call Pentecost. That's right. And then in the seventh month on the 15th day, you have the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths. Now, what does it mean, the Feast of Booths? What is a booth? What? A man, what did they make these booths out of? Very good. The branches of trees, they put them together. You see? So it's not a tabernacle. You think of a tabernacle like the tabernacle that Moses built. But this is the Feast of Booths. And God is reminding them what they went through when they first came out of the land of Egypt. All right. Thinking now of these feasts. When you have the Feast of the Passover, this reminds us about Israel in what way?
Deliverance.
Give me one word that will sum it all up.
Redemption.
Very good. Let me ask you this. I doubt if you know it. Suppose I were giving away prizes, and I said I'll give one to Tim, and one to Kevin, and then I'll give one to Wolfgang. What did I do to you? Very good. Do you know that the word Passover means to skip?
Right.
All right. So what did I do? I skip over who? Nick. You understand? And the word Passover means to skip over in sparing mercy. Isn't that beautiful? That's the basic meaning of the word. Now, Nick was sad that I skipped over him because I was going to give away a prize. But if it were a judgment and I skipped over him, it would rejoice his heart.
And so the word Pesach, which is the verb, and Pesach, which is the noun, it simply means to pass over, and you understand that God passed over them in sparing mercy. That is the meaning of that first appointment. All right, let me ask you this about it. When you consider their life, you consider it historically. Why? Is the Passover, now that we're reading about Leviticus 23, is it something present or is it a history of something that happened in the past? It's history. And so they consider their appointment historically. The Passover is past. When they stay in booths, what does that do? It reminds them of their history. All right. So these feasts collectively look upon Israel historically. And then they look upon Israel experientially. Because, and I don't want any New Testament interpretations, we'll get that later. What did the Feast of Unleavened Bread mean to them according to what God says in the Old Testament? The Feast of Unleavened Bread.
Remember that you had to eat.
What?
This reminds you that you didn't have time to let your bread rise.
Very good. That's mentioned twice. That's very good. The urgency, the immediacy of it, because you'll read that they didn't have time to let the dough rise and have leavened bread. And so it's a reminder again of what? But when? It's history. The Passover, the slaying of the lamb, is history. The Feast of Unleavened Bread is history. Now.
I'm sorry, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Could you repeat the phrase, Passover, the way you said it?
To pass over in sparing mercy.
Right.
It means to skip over. And I showed you. I gave you a prize, Kevin. I skipped over Nick. And then I gave one to Wolfgang. And so I skipped over Nick. And so the Passover means that God skipped over them. He passed over them in sparing mercy. All right. Now think, and we're getting closer. So these feasts speak of Israel in relation to God. How? The first word?
Historically.
All right. Now think. We have the Passover. We have unleavened bread. That's history. And now we have first fruits. Where do you get first fruits from?
From the crop.
And so, what did they grow in the wilderness?
Nothing.
Nothing. So, that is speaking of Israel in what way?
Recognizing
the land.
What?
Promised land.
One word. It's they're in the promised land. That's anticipated.
Provision.
But it's remember what?
Provision. Remembering
that. Agriculturally. If you have first fruits, what have you planted? Exactly. And if you have the harvest, what have you done? You've planted. You understand? So this looks upon Israel agriculturally. But this anticipates what is going to happen when they get into the promised land. When they get into the promised land, it's very significant. It says that a change in their provision immediately happens. Mm-hmm. What? What did they eat for 40 years?
The manna.
The manna ceased, and what did they eat? The old corn of the land. Mm-hmm. The produce of the land. They're in the promised land. You understand? And then they ate it then, but afterwards God said, you have to plant. And that is why every seventh year, agriculturally, what did they plant the seventh year? Nothing. But they did. That's why they went into captivity.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to let the land lie fallow and plant nothing. But they planted it, And they planted it. They failed for all these years. And 7 times 70 is how long? 490 years. 7 into 490 will go how many times? And how long is the captivity? 70 years. And so God said, you cheated me? For 70 years I told you to let the land lie fallow, and you didn't. He said, when you're in captivity, you'll let the land lie fallow. You understand? And so if you don't give God what he asked for, what is God able to do? Not in this instance. He didn't put him in jail. He sent them into captivity. Yes, that's right. But it was worse than being in jail. They were slaves. At least in jail, you hope you're going to get out after a period of time. And so God did promise them that after 70 years, they would be redeemed. So we think that we can trick God. This is how it was put. You see, here is the 7th year, and God told me not to plant. Well, I think I'll try it anyway. And so they planted, and it grew, and they had a harvest. And so they said, everything is all right. We can plant the 7th year. There's no penalty. And so God let it go by for how many years? 490 years. And then finally he said, this is the time. And so every 7th year was to belong to God. And so 7 into 490 is 70. And so God said, I will give you a captivity of 7 years. Now, there are 70 years, and then I told you about 70 times 7. How did Daniel know that God was going to restore Israel after 70 years? Where?
Jeremiah.
Very good. Jeremiah 25. This is what is so interesting. Daniel was a prophet, but he didn't say, Lord, I'm not going to read the Bible. You just give it to me. That would be nice if he did. He was reading the book of Jeremiah, and he found in chapter 25, and again, that after 70 years, God would bless Israel. And so he started thinking not of 70 years only, but of 7 times 70 years, and he tells as to when the Messiah is going to come upon the scene. So, we're talking about Israel. Remember, originally the question is, why are these things put together collectively, and what do they tell us about Israel collectively? So inasmuch as you have the Passover, is that historical? Is the unleavened bread, eating it, historical? Of course it is. Is being in booths historical? Of course it is. So we have Israel looked at historically, and we have Israel looked at agriculturally, and then we have Israel looked at in what different way now? Is enough? What?
Prophetically.
I don't know if they know that from this. You're going to project prophecy in it, but at the time, Israel didn't know that. Look at them as a people that had experienced mercy. It says, at one time you were not shown mercy, but now you have been shown mercy. And what one day was specially set aside to emphasize the forgiveness of sins for Israel. Very, very good. So we have religiously, and there's one other feast that tells us another thing about Israel. The blowing of trumpets. That is Israel looked upon in communion with God and with one another, because, as you mentioned, the feast individually, where is this feast spoken of, the blowing of trumpets? Individually, where did it originate? Numbers what? 10. Numbers 10. And this is when God had them to make 2 silver trumpets. So now think of it as a whole. You say, he looked at them historically, agriculturally. He looked at them in communion with one another. And he looked at them as a people who have experienced mercy and who need forgiveness and also who want to maintain unbroken fellowship with God. So that is how it appears when you look at these feasts collectively. But if you look at them individually, if you look at the feast of the Passover, does that tell us anything about Israel in booths? And in booths, does that tell us anything about the Day of Atonement? You say no. Each one has its individual message. But when they're brought together collectively, they give us a bigger picture. They give us an entire picture of Israel in their relationship with God and in their relationship with one another. When you have the Feast of First Fruits, is that in their relationship with one another or to God? To God. But when they have the Feast of Booths, that is in their relationship with one another. Their holy convocation. Whenever they come together and jointly worship God and carry out the rituals associated with this appointment, then that is how they are looked at in their communion with one another. All right. Are there any questions? Yes.
Historically,
the trumpets weren't in existence, and when we get to it, we'll look at it. But the blowing of the trumpets was at every appointment of God. They were blown at every appointment of God. First of all, they were ordered so that Israel might know what they're supposed to do. Suppose you have thousands and thousands of people, and you don't have a telephone, and you don't have one of these sirens on top of a building to warn you when a storm is coming. How would you get people together? You're going to knock on doors. They didn't have any bells, so God made two trumpets. And what do you think they did with the trumpets? They blew on them. They blew the trumpets for the gathering together of the people. And when they blew those trumpets, each sound and each particular way that they blew them was a signal to Israel. Isn't that remarkable? So if they blew two of the trumpets, who was to come? Everybody. If they blew one of the trumpets, who was to come? The princes. Very good. And then if they sounded an alarm, what was to happen? They were ready to move. All right. I mentioned that. We'll go into it more and read Numbers 10 a little later, God willing. But these trumpets, once they got into the promised land, and they were hundreds and hundreds of miles away from each other, if I blew a trumpet in Jerusalem, could I hear it in Beersheba? And so the trumpets for the nation of Israel were in particular for them for the 40 years in the wilderness. You understand? But after they got into the promised land, they still used those trumpets, but for different reasons. Every festival, every appointment that they had, they would blow these trumpets. Whenever the new moon came up, they would blow the trumpets. Whenever they offered their sacrifices, they would blow the trumpets. And so that wasn't in the wilderness, but that was showing their communion and fellowship. Here is God blowing these trumpets. And since we've done it, these trumpets, when they are blown, no, I won't go into it now because it will involve asking you too much. But just remember that one of these feasts was the blowing of the trumpets, and it would have no significance to Israel historically because they are no longer in the wilderness, they are in the promised land, and nobody could hear it. All right, any questions now?
Yes. Why is the majority of translations consistently translate that Hebrew into the word feast?
Because, just like this, it says, a feast of blowing of trumpets. You realize that the word trumpet doesn't even occur in the Hebrew. But they made the silver trumpets, and so it supplied. You see? It says the Passover. I had to add the Passover how? In sparing mercy. There are some things you have to supply. And so that's a good question. They put feast because it's something that is left that you have to put in because of what you know. And I'm telling you what it is. And so these are simply fixed times. These are appointments that God has given. I won't show it to you now, but just hold that in mind. Any other questions now?
In reference to the abandoning or choosing to plant on the seventh year when they were told not to, one might could conclude that they were planting because they did not believe that God was able to provide what they needed. They had to take care of themselves, but it seems that, I don't know, can't think of any place where we're told why they chose to plant.
I think that is an excellent observation, and had you read in Leviticus chapter 25 about the Jubilee, you would understand that same thing, because the question that you asked, God said, that's what's going to come up in your mind. Right. What are we going to eat if we don't plant? Okay. You see? So the very thing that you were thinking about, Tim, God anticipated. And he told them, I've anticipated that, and I promise you that you can eat what is left over. And when you when you plant on the eighth year, I promise that you'll get a bumper crop. So you had to trust God for 3 years. That's scary, isn't it?
That's right.
You come to the sixth year. Well, what if it were a poor harvest that year? Then what would you be tempted to do the seventh year? The plant. But God said, I'll give you enough in the sixth year, the last year, the seventh year, and I promise you that when you plant in the eighth year, you'll get a crop of food. So how long did they have to trust God? Isn't that remarkable, isn't it?
Not only that, you have to release. If you're my slave, I don't want to let you go. I want you to work for me like you've been doing 6 years.
Very good.
You had to release your possessions, as it were.
And Tim, God already anticipated that. He said, it shall not seem hard unto you when you let him go. Everything that you are thinking, God has already anticipated.
Exactly.
You see? So isn't this wonderful how Tim is thinking just what the Lord said? This is what you're going to think, Tim. He knows about being hard. He wouldn't let me go if I were his slave, you see? And so the Lord has to tell him about it. And so all of these things are anticipated. That's fine. Any question now? Any suggestion? All right. Tell you what I'm going to do. This will get your attention. In all the recorded instances, how many times was the Passover kept in the Old Testament? I tell you what I'll do. What?
I said three.
Three. Three times in the whole Testament, the Passover is recorded as being kept. I'm laughing now. But think now, in all the years from Exodus 12, I was going to tell you, if you could tell me, Tim, how many times it was recorded and what they were, I will give anybody $100 if they can tell me. I feel safer now. I was a little nervous a moment ago. But now, I feel safe. One time? You know Exodus 12, you're safe there. Very good. One. Tim, you said three times. Give me two more.
I was thinking of when King Josiah.
That's excellent. That's one of the times. Yes. Anybody else? Let's help Tim with three anyway. All right, listen to them. In Exodus 12, in Numbers 9, in Joshua 5, in 2 Chronicles 30, in 2 Chronicles 35, and in Ezekiel 45. So how many times is that? You have Exodus 12, Numbers 9, Joshua 5, 2 Chronicles 30, 2 Chronicles 35, Ezra 6, and Ezekiel 45. How many is that in all?
Seven
times. But one of them is prophetical. The one in Ezekiel 45. You see, this is what makes it so significant. There is going to be a millennium, and during the millennium, one of the feasts, one of the appointments that's going to be kept is the Passover. So, do you see how much is involved? That's why, when you said, Uncle John, teach us all of these feasts in Leviticus 23, you don't know what that involves, trying to find out all of these things. Because one thing leads to another. You have the blowing of trumpets. All right, I could look at Numbers chapter 10 and get that. But then I've got to see about the blowing of trumpets on all these other occasions. You understand? All right, any questions now?
As far as God's concerned, we can say that the celebrating of the Passover that's done now is perhaps, this may be a daring statement, but is perhaps insignificant. The significance of it will begin again during the millennium.
Well, the point that God said for Israel...
You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, but God said for Israel, it was so important, it was to be greatly observed. This is a night that historically is the most important night in your life.
Right.
It shall never be forgotten, you see? And so that is why it's so great. When did Israel come together and get redemption as a nation? When did they come together and get redemption as a nation? All right, I'll tell you this now. I'll start putting things together. You have Passover. Very good, Tim. Passover. In two...
Tom was individually.
In two... Very good. The Passover is individually. And what is the atonement?
Well, the atonement was individually.
No, no. The Day of Atonement was...
You're saying that was collective?
I'm not saying it. Mm-hmm. They didn't offer anything. The high priest on the Day of Atonement went into the Holy of Holies. And so he did it representatively for Israel.
I see.
You
yeah,
see?
Yeah.
All right. But... Now, this is what is so excellent, and if you can see these things, I haven't told you anything about its significance in the New Testament yet, but in two of these appointments, there is especially mentioned the shedding of blood. What are the two?
Passover.
Very good. You've got them. Now, in the Passover, what priest shed the blood?
The individual priest.
Very good. The head of the family. Mm-hmm. And that's what you'll find. Because it says before there were any priests, God had made priests later, he said, the priest shall do this or that. You'll find that in the nation of Israel, the fathers were the ones that functioned as priests. When Job's sons and daughters, when he thought they had sinned, what did he do every day after they got together?
Made sacrifice.
What?
Made sacrifice.
Very good. And he did it as a what?
Priest.
As a priest, you see. You have those priests. But then after, you'll find Exodus 19, God wanted all Israel to be priests. But he finally chose the family of Aaron to be priests. And he chose the tribe of Levi to have the service of the tabernacle. So there is the shedding of blood. And so if the shedding of blood is individual in Exodus 12, it's collective in Leviticus 16. When it is the shedding of blood, and I must anticipate, here is the shedding of blood. What was done with the blood when the priest shed the blood, when the tabernacle and the temple were built? It went on the altar. Very good. It went on the altar. But when the blood was shed in Egypt, where did it go?
Doorposts.
Very good. How did it get on those doorposts?
Hyssop.
I see. So, there was not only the shedding of blood, but they had to put it in a basin. They had to dip hyssop in that blood in the basin and apply it to the doorpost as a lintel. You understand? Each individual had to do that, and having put it on his door, did that give him safety from the destroyer?
Yes.
No, it didn't. God said, you've got to go in behind that blood, and if you come out, I'm not going to be responsible for you. If you come out behind that blood, when that destroying angel is going through, what would happen? He would be destroyed. You understand? So, it is dealing with the blood individually in Exodus chapter 12, but it is dealing with the blood, and who does the shedding of the blood in Leviticus 16 on the Day of Atonement? The priest. And whom do you think that priest represents? Who is it that has entered into heaven by his own blood? Exactly. So who do you think is spoken of in the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16? Christ. And the blood goes on the altar. But in Exodus 12, the blood is in the basin and then it goes on the door. I must tell you this. When you have the blood shed and the lamb on the brazen altar, that is Christ and his death on Calvary. Where is the one place that we know that Christ died? Exactly. At the place of the skull, at Calvary, at Golgotha. So when you have a lamb on the brazen altar and its blood shed and applied, that is Christ dying where? On the cross. But here is blood in Exodus chapter 12, and it has nothing to do with the brazen altar. But somebody takes a piece of hyssop, dips it in the blood, and puts it on his door. What do you think that might represent? Who does it? Sprinkle? What does it do with the blood? Figure it out now. Who was responsible in Exodus 12 for killing the lamb? Exactly. They were responsible. And who was responsible to apply that blood to the doorpost? Very good. So this is the personal responsibility of each individual applying the shed blood of Christ to his own place of abode. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. And so you have Christ, what he does with the blood in Leviticus 16. Where does he take the blood?
To the cross.
No, he shed it on the cross. Where does he take the blood?
To the altar.
He entered into heaven itself by his own blood. Christ takes the blood. Where? Into heaven. But what was done with the blood by the individual? It was applied to his own personal need. His whole family. That's what is so beautiful. That Christ has died on the cross. How many sinners will it save simply because he died?
No.
Not one. But what happens when that sinner takes hyssop and dips it in that blood, Tim, and applies it to the door? What happens?
He receives blood.
Well, of course he does. You understand? It is applying the salvation, the power of the precious blood to his own individual need. And that is the beauty of the Passover. So remember, you have blood shed twice in these feasts, in the Passover, and then you have it on the Day of Atonement. One of them is Christward, one of them is manward. Any questions now? Have you figured that out, how we put it together? If you have the answer but you don't know how to put it together, it won't do you any good.
So we can say in Exodus 12, that blood was shed for the family. Leviticus 16, that's for the whole world.
Inasmuch as the blood that was shed there was no altar. There was no priest